Good morning. We're happy to welcome Faith Christian School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have Berlin High School. Would those students please stand? We want to thank you all for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar in this court. This program invites students from around the state to come and listen to an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students are sent materials about this case, and they may engage in some activities relating to the case. They come, listen to oral argument, and after the second oral argument, this one, the students will join up with students who have been here in the, during the first case, and a justice assigned for that day will speak to the students about the procedures the court uses for deciding what cases to take and how we decide cases. The substantive issues of the cases will not be discussed. And anyone who wishes to join the students may do so. Age and education will not be a barrier to admission. Does anyone here want a summary of this case? It's easier to understand if you know something about the case, because we have summaries of it. If you'd raise your hand, we'd be delighted to give it to you. Now, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack, who will meet with the students at noon today. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our second case for today, 08AP2897, Link Snacks, Inc. versus J.E. Link. Representing... We've got an appeal and a review and cross review, and the way I've got the lineup here is 20 minutes for Mr. Michael Abrahamian, representing J.E. Link. He will be introduced by Wisconsin Attorney Webster Hart.
That's not the other
side. Right there.
That's the other side. Okay. 20 minutes for Brian P. Norton. And he will have 20 minutes. This is the schedule and time determined by your joint agreement, as I understand it. 10 minutes for Michael Abrahamian for response reply, and 10 minutes for Brian P. Norton, representing John Link, for a reply. Right? We got it? Okay. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Justice Abrahamson, counsel. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Abrahamian, and I represent J.E. Link. He's the petitioner and cross-respondent. With me at counsel table is Mike Bowen. We're both from the firm Foley & Lardner. And as I say, we represent J. Link. We are here seeking reversal of a Court of Appeals order that held that J. Link voluntarily waived his claims pending on appeal that were fully briefed on appeal, because he complied with a post-appeal circuit court order requiring him to sell his shares in Link Snacks pursuant to a buy-sell agreement, and Jay did so without seeking a stay of that order.
Now, was title transferred?
Yes, Your Honor.
So he's no longer a shareholder?
He's no longer a shareholder pursuant to that court's order, Your Honor.
So he's limited in any of his rights as a non-shareholder?
That depends, Your Honor, because I believe there are rights he has that were accrued and pending at the time he was a shareholder, and I was going to discuss that under the notes decision, as well as even the claim he had for judicial dissolution that was pending at the time of the order, he would still have rights under that decision.
And even though he's no longer a shareholder.
Even though he's no longer a shareholder. The notes decision, Justice Crooks' decision in that case, made very clear was distinguishing between derivative claims and direct action claims for breach of fiduciary duty and which could be pursued. And it was very clear that once the court held that some of the claims were still direct claims that the plaintiff there could pursue, even though that plaintiff was no longer a shareholder because he had been bought out under the merger, those claims that had accrued prior to that time were still pending, and he had a right to pursue those claims for breach of fiduciary duty. In addition, because a judicial dissolution claim was viewed as a direct claim, those claims could still be pursued even though he was no longer a shareholder. And Justice Rogenstack's concurrence made very clear that it was all about money at that point. He had been bought out, and the claim that remained after he was no longer a shareholder was just whether he was entitled to more money as a fair value remedy for the statutory tort of oppression. Now, here the Court of Appeals held that because Jay didn't seek a stay of the circuit court order, that he accepted benefits that he would not be entitled to if he succeeded on appeal. The court didn't provide much detail in explaining the claims that Jay had on appeal and didn't explain with respect to those claims why, if in fact he was successful, he would not be entitled to the $19.4 million he would get under the buy-sell agreement. I think the starting point here, Your Honors, is to look at the claims he had on appeal. One claim he had on appeal, one challenge he had on appeal, was a challenge against Jack and Troy individually. Not against Link Snacks, but against Jack and Troy individually. And in that appeal, he was challenging various orders that precluded him from seeking and recovering disgorgement level of damages, ill-gotten gain level of damages, which are established under Wisconsin law and other cases and circumstances like this. And it prevented him from, the court prevented Jay Link from pursuing those damages, and that was what was on appeal against Jack and Troy individually for their breach of fiduciary duty, which was found by the jury and which was not appealed. The other challenge he had on appeal is a challenge against the finding, the circuit court's refusal to find oppression, despite the fact that the jury had found breaches of fiduciary duty by Jack and Troy, despite the fact that it awarded punitive damages to the tune of $5 million, believing that Jack's breaches were malicious or an intentional disregard of Jay's rights, and despite the fact that the circuit court held that if, in fact, there was a breach of fiduciary duty found by the jury, it would find oppression.
But wasn't there an inopposite finding of a $5 million punitive damage award against imposed on your client? So a fair reading of that would indicate the jury intended anyway a wash.
I don't believe that's fair, Your Honor, because they're against different parties. The parties against which Jay was awarded punitive damage against were companies for which there were nominal damages awarded against Jay, and that's why those were...
That company, including Jack Link?
Including Link Snacks, Inc.
Right.
There was punitive damage award against Jay for breach of fiduciary duty against Link Snacks, Inc., as well as against the company LSI, Inc. But those were unsupportable under the law. That's not been challenged on appeal. There were nominal damages awarded against Jay under tort claims, either zero or only $1, that would not support punitive damages. So those have been, they're not part of the case. The challenge that Jay had on appeal was the oppression claim and the challenge to the ill-gotten gain level of damages that the court would not let him pursue.
Counselor, I'm interested in your claim where, if I understand you correctly, what you're asking for is damages against Jack and Troy based on oppression, which you claim is the same as breach of fiduciary duty, and I'll ask you about that a little bit later. And the damages are measured by the difference between the fair market value, which was paid under the buy-sell agreement, and the fair value, which would have been the value of his shares, say, at dissolution. Is that right?
Almost exactly right. We weren't suing them for oppression because they're the individual directors and officers, we were suing them for breach of fiduciary duty.
Okay,
the oppression was against the company. But other than that, you have exactly right, Your Honor.
Okay, well, you didn't get a finding of oppression. So what I have a concern with is you got $736,000 as compensatory damages for breach of fiduciary duty. And that's against Jack, right?
Against Jack, Your
Honor.
Okay. That's correct.
What does that relate to? I mean, I don't see how it relates to your damages for the difference that we spoke of.
There are two types of damages that could be pursued for the breach of fiduciary duty claim. One would be out-of-pocket type of expenses here, perhaps his salary for a year. And this is under the restatement, second of courts, 903 and 874.
So the jury took a year's salary.
We're essentially speculating, but that could be what justifies the 736. The judge let us pursue the out-of-pocket expense damages, but precluded us from pursuing the 903B level of damages, which is the ill-gotten gain, the disgorgement of the benefit that they had. Because they're able to acquire those shares on the cheap for fair market value, $19.4 million, when they had a value based upon their own appraisers at either $32 million or $48 million, that ill-gotten gain is a level of damages. And it's the difference, as you say. It's not an award of fair value. It's the difference.
Difference, right. I understood that. I didn't have a problem with that. I guess, you know, I was looking at it as the value that might be determined at dissolution of the company at the moment that he left. But if the jury already awarded you compensatory damages for breach of fiduciary duty, you're just saying that award was too low? Is that what you're saying?
It is, because we weren't allowed to pursue the ill-gotten gain level damages to put in what the fair value of these shares are.
Gotcha.
He never permitted us to put that in.
Okay, I got you.
They argued to the jury that they're willing to pay $19.4 million under the buy-sell agreement, and they planned on doing that. What we never were allowed to put in was the fair value number, what these shares were actually worth. And to permit the jury, upon their finding of a breach of fiduciary duty, to award damages as that difference, that delta, which reflects the ill-gotten gain that they had. This is an established level of damages under the restatement. Yeah. We cite cases from other jurisdictions, and the court didn't let us pursue that. I think he justified it, and he said he justified it, because he said, look, if you're going to get a finding of breach of fiduciary duty, I'm going to find oppression, and you're going to get fair value anyway. Now, I disagree with that reasoning because they're against different parties. We have a right to pursue alternative remedies. But the punchline, the real rub for us is we did get the finding of breach of fiduciary duty, and then he still didn't find oppression, and we still didn't get fair value.
So what you want is you want to be able to retry a part of this case?
The damages for breach of fiduciary duty, or alternatively, remand back for an oppression finding and a remedy for the oppression.
He already found there was no oppression. That's what he
did, but that's what we had challenged on appeal, Your Honor. And we believe it's pretty clear under Wisconsin law, given the kind of mirror aspect under the cases, Jorgensen and some of the other cases, that if you have a finding of breach of fiduciary duty, that conduct reflects burdensome, harsh, and wrongful conduct on the part of the corporate actors and a visual departure of the standards of fair play that support an oppression finding.
Well, there's other breaches of fiduciary duty. If you read the Journal Sentinel case, there's breach of fiduciary duty found in that case, and there was no oppression that was at issue.
But we believe we would be entitled to that, particularly given the actions in this case and the award of punitive damages. We think that's an inconsistent finding. But what the Court of Appeals held was, if we were successful on these challenges, we wouldn't be entitled to that $19.4 million, and because we didn't seek a stay, therefore we've waived those claims. And it didn't have a proper understanding, I believe, of Stevens Construction and didn't properly interpret what our claims are. I think the starting point that we have to address is this case is controlled by Stevens Construction. The other side spends very little time on it. It cites cases from other jurisdictions. It spends half its brief talking what a bad guy Jay is, but it doesn't apply the standard and what our claims actually were. If you look at Stevens Construction.
Before we do that, if you would remand for oppression, to whom would you remand?
We'd remand back to the circuit court.
And you retry, you would remand to the circuit court, right?
That's correct. And for the breach of fiduciary duty, we'd remand. We already have a finding of breach of fiduciary duty. Now it's just a damages trial on that breach.
What was the breach of fiduciary duty here?
Breach of fiduciary duty We lay it out in our, largely in our response to their brief, Your Honor. And again, it has been found and it's not been appealed, but there was some tension between the various Link family members. It became very clear that something had to be done. They went through a process by which Jack Link, who was the chairman and CEO, said, I'll abide by whatever the managers and directors say needs to be done in the best interest of the company. They did it through this process. They came to a conclusion. Jack should step out of day-to-day operations and should no longer be CEO. His two sons should be co-CEOs of a divided business. That's what they held. And they believed that Jay should stay within the company because he was an asset to the company. If there was any real issue, they wanted Jay to handle it.
So what was the breach of fiduciary?
Jack then reasserted control. This is a memo that he issued. Reasserted control of the entire meat snack operations, removed all of Jay's responsibilities in the companies, and Jay was an officer of the companies. And under the bylaws, you can't remove these officer responsibilities, particularly if you remove all of them. If you remove all of them, that's a constructive termination, and only the board can terminate him. We have testimony from directors of the company.
What was the breach? I still haven't heard what the breach was.
He then terminated Jay without going through the board and in violation of the bylaws. He then demanded that for Jay to stay on at the company, Jay would have to give him millions of dollars that Jay earned on the sale of a business that Jack had, his father, had no involvement in.
What's the fiduciary duty?
The fiduciary duty is to use his pressure, his authority as majority shareholder and chairman and CEO of Link Snacks, Inc. and these other companies to force Jay to give Jay money that he was not entitled to and to require Jay to turn over his shares into a holding company and give up all of his voting rights.
So the duty was to run the company for the benefit of the company.
The benefit of the company and not take self-serving advantage by using his authority in Link Snacks as majority shareholder and chairman and CEO and say, Jay, you can stay on, but you have to give me one-third of $20 million, and you have to turn over all your shares in these other companies into a holding company and give up all your voting rights. And Jay said, I'm not going to do that. That's not fair. The jury found that that was a breach. The circuit court found that that was a breach. The circuit court highlighted that evidence for support of punitive damages.
Are there any other matters at issue between the parties that the Court of Appeals did not reach that have to go back to the Court of Appeals?
The two issues that were, the two challenges that were dismissed that I'm raising now are the only two. There was the punitive damage award that was a subject of a separate decision that my adversaries to my left are going to be arguing about on their cross petition. But other than those two appellate challenges that were dismissed, no, they decided the various part of the claim.
Counselor, is statutory oppression a question of fact or a question of law?
I believe it's a mixed question of fact and law.
Okay, and tell me what the mix is.
The mix is there can be certain facts that have to be found to support that, but ultimately it's going to come down to a legal decision as to whether this conduct is burdensome, harsh, and wrongful, and visually departs from the standards of fair play. I'm quoting Jorgensen, that's the standard. That's a legal standard, and how that's applied is going to be a mixed question of law and fact. Here, the findings of fact of breach of fiduciary duty were not found by the court, they were found by the jury. So those are binding. The circuit court couldn't have set those aside unless there was not enough evidence to support it. Obviously, there was. There's been no challenge to that.
But you don't have a finding that the conduct was burdensome. You have a finding it was a breach of fiduciary duty, and you don't have a finding on all the factual standards of Jorgensen. If I understood what you said before, it's because you said the trial court wouldn't let you present that part of your case.
It wouldn't let us present it on the breach of fiduciary duty.
Right.
But on the oppression, that's what we were challenging on appeal on the merits, is the failure of the circuit court to find oppression given these facts. And that's what's on appeal. And that's what was dismissed without any decision on the merits of the appeal.
I understand that, but from what the jury answered, the question they answered was whether or not Jack breached his fiduciary duty, I thought, as a majority shareholder to Jay as a minority shareholder, but be that as it may, they didn't say how. I mean, breach of fiduciary duty wears a lot of hats, in my view.
Right.
And I guess I'm trying to figure out, if you need a trial on the facts, you're saying no just on the damages for breach of fiduciary duty?
For breach of fiduciary duty, we already have that finding, and the only issue is what amount of damages can we get and can we get the ill-gotten gain. Putting that aside now to talk about oppression and judicial dissolution, that was something I'd go back to the court based upon guidance from this court as to how, what the standard would be and whether you have to have a finding of oppression in light of these breaches of fiduciary duty and the conduct taking place in this case.
Okay, fine.
That's what was briefed on the merits that they never got to.
Yeah.
It's important to talk about Stevens construction because there are essentially two corollaries. One is, it says you're not prevented from taking an appeal if the orders that you're challenging and the order from which you're getting a benefit are separate and independent. So there's a separate and independent corollary. And there's also the corollary that says if it's impossible for you to get less if you're successful on your appeal, you still are not prevented from taking the appeal. Both of the appeals that we have challenged, all we need to fit is into one of those corollaries, we fit into both. And it's easy to start with the breach of fiduciary duty claim. That is against different parties. It's against Jack and Troy. It's not against Link Snacks, the order from which we got a benefit. It's the order on the buy-sell agreement from Link Snacks. And not only do we get the benefit of that, the breach of fiduciary duty claim presumes that that order will stay in place. We're not challenging that buy-sell judgment and the $19.4 million under our breach of fiduciary duty.
Right, so you're saying even if you get zero from Jack and Troy individually, the $19.4 million awards.
Exactly, Your Honor, because it's all we're seeking is the difference, the delta. We've not challenged that order. So they're separate and independent. By succeeding on our appeal to say we should get ill-gotten gain damages, we haven't called into question that buy-sell agreement.
Well, the buy-sell agreement is a contract anyway, and you're arguing the tort, right?
Exactly, Your Honor. In addition, it's impossible for us to get less. The Court of Appeals speculated that if we get a remand on some successful appellate challenge, that it'll have to recalculate what the damages would be under the buy-sell agreement. And because it's possible that it could go lower, that we don't fit within the corollary under the Stevens construction. The Court of Appeals misinterpreted the buy-sell agreement. The buy-sell agreement would not require a further evaluation. It's stuck in time as of July 31, 2005. Based upon that date, appraisers were hired pursuant to the procedure in the buy-sell, and they came up with the magic number of 19.4. That's the number that's fixed for the buy-sell agreement. And because it's fixed contractually, that's what they're stuck with. And not only are they stuck with it under the contract, they've never appealed that. They're stuck by res judicata and claim preclusion to pay us $19.4 million on the buy-sell agreement.
You've been paid part of it, not totally.
I'm sorry?
You have been paid part of that.
Part of it, totally. Not total. That's exactly
okay,
right.
Go ahead.
Does the buy-sell agreement zero in on July 31, 2005?
It does, Your Honor, but it doesn't say that date. It says the end of the month preceding the date of the event, and it stipulated that it was July 31, 2005, and they don't dispute that the $19.4 million number is the number that is generated under the buy-sell. We're stuck with that number under the buy-sell. We can't get less than that. We can't get less than that on our breach of fiduciary duty claim. We can't get less than that under the oppression claim, because they never appealed that judgment. They're obligated to pay $19.4 million.
But you didn't appeal it either, so you can't get any more under the buy-sell, right?
We can't get any more under the buy-sell, and that was a mistake, I believe, from the Court of Appeals. They assumed that we were trying to get more under a contract or quasi-contract claim. We're not. We're trying to get more under the breach of fiduciary duty tort claim against the individuals and under the statutory remedy of oppression against Link Snacks. So we're assuming that that number stays for the contract, but the only question is, do we get more under oppression? I think I'm at my 20 minutes. I'll have a chance, I think, to respond to any questions when I get my
turn. So what are you going to cover in your...
I'm going to cover a response to what Mr. Norton has on my appeal, and then I'll also respond to his initial arguments on his petition.
Thank you, counsel. Mr.
May it please the court. I'm Webster Hart from Eau Claire, I represent the petitioner Jack Link, John E. Link, as well as the respondents in Jay Link's petition. I'd like to introduce to the court my friend and co-counsel Brian Norton of the law firm of Freeborn and Peters in Chicago. Mr. Norton will be presenting the argument on behalf of our clients. Thank you for this opportunity.
He's licensed in good standing in the upper states.
He is licensed in good standing in Chicago and has been admitted pro hoc vici for the purposes of this case, as well as others in Wisconsin.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Norton.
Privilege and honor of being able to argue in front of you today in the courtesy.
You can even become a member of our bar under our new rules.
I tried
to
do that.
Then you have to pay dues.
The bar needs the money.
Not a bad idea, Your Honor. Your Honor, there are three points I'd like to make, broad points, and I'll get into the details. Today I'll be both responding to Mr. Abrahamian's argument and presenting our argument on Jack's appeal with respect to the Treadway decision and the filing of the motion letter 80516. The three points I'd like to make in response to Mr. Abrahamian are, one, Jay's contention that he was wrongfully terminated as part of a shareholder squeeze-out by management of the companies is not supported by the record, the findings of this case, or the findings by the court. Two, Jay voluntarily accepted the benefits of the judgment under specific performance of $19.4 million, and in reliance on his acceptance, LinkSnex spent $3 million to try to be in a position to be able to close that transaction during the midst of the credit crisis. And three, by voluntarily accepting the benefits of that judgment, Jay Link waived his remaining appeals because the only way that he can recover under those two judgments is by reversing the judgment for specific performance. That's the only basis by which he can pursue those claims.
Why is that, Counselor, when the buy-sell agreement gives him contract damages and he's asking for tort damages? Why does the buy-sell preclude his tort damages?
Let's take them one at a time. He has two remaining claims. One is a claim for dissolution under 180.14.30. Mm-hmm. For oppression. He also has the claim for money damages against Jack and Troy. Mm-hmm. With respect to the claim for dissolution, and in this case, it was an either-or proposition. Either he could dissolve the corporation or he could bought out for fair market value under the buy-sell agreement.
Why?
Because at the end of the day, both turn on a single question. Was Jay Link oppressed? Oppression is both a defense to a claim for specific performance of contract and a basis for a claim under 1430. That's one of the bases for a claim. If the court found that there was oppression, there'd be no basis to assert the claim for breach of, for the interference, no basis to enforce the contract. If there was oppression, he would have a grounds to dissolve the corporation. It was either one or the other. Perhaps I haven't said that correctly. If there was oppression, that's a defense to a claim for specific performance. He cannot enforce the contract if there's oppression. If there's no oppression. If there is oppression, then he has a remedy under the statute, 11430. It's either one or the other. Jay can only get paid for his shares in this case in one of two ways, either by liquidation or equitable remedies under 1430 or by the contract. Those are the only two options. In this case, the judge concluded that there was nothing wrong with selling Jay's shares pursuant to the buy-sell agreement. He found there was no oppression. It was perfectly lawful and appropriate to give Jay the benefit of the bargain that he reached when he got his shares in the first place.
You're in effect saying it's a choice of remedies. Once you make that choice and go with it, you can't have it the other way.
Exactly. And I think it's more than that, because basically, if you think about it, Mr. Abrahamian said, and I think this is fatal to his claim, there's a presumption that the court's order enforcing specific performance will stay in place. If that's true, he cannot pursue his remedy for dissolution. And the reason is this. The judge concluded, his contention is that we wrongfully retained some kind of benefit by not paying him fair value for his shares. I'll put aside the fact that fair value is not a remedy recognized by law for a jury damage position, but he says, I'm entitled between fair market value and fair value because they wrongfully got my shares at fair market value. But we have a judgment in place, it's not challenged, that says there's nothing wrong with you getting the shares for that price. The court has concluded it was perfectly appropriate for the corporation to buy you out at fair market value. He cannot pursue a claim for dissolution of a corporation on the basis that we wrongfully obtained the shares for $19.4 million as long as that judgment stands, because that judgment was a judgment that said it's perfectly appropriate, lawful, and not oppressive to buy him out at fair market value. In order to recover, he has to reverse the judgment for specific performance of the contract. That's the only way it can work. Otherwise, you have two judgments that are completely in conflict, and collateral estoppel bars him from arguing it was wrongful that we obtained its benefits under the contract when we're sitting there with a judgment by a court that tells us we have to buy our shares at that value, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Is there another way of stating that you can't sue on the contract and at the same and get the benefit of the contract and then sue to get rid of the contract?
That's the whole notion of acceptance by the waiver doctrine. He accepted the benefits. He can't pursue the alternative remedies. He can't do it. There's another issue. There's a second reason, by the way, that he can't do it as well. And the second reason is, and this is a standing question, once a shareholder sells his shares, he no longer is standing to assert claims for dissolution of a corporation. He cited the Knotts case. The Knotts case dealt with the merger statute and had the specific language of 1106 that says claims persevere at the time of the merger occurred. There is no similar language in the dissolution statute.
That's why I asked my question about that. That bothers me. So if you want to dissolve, you can't sell your shares. I mean, that's your point you're trying to make.
Correct.
So the shares have been sold, and there's no similar statute to Knotts.
My understanding of Knotts' case is the basis for why the court ultimately concluded standing persists was that express language in 1106. There is no similar express language in 1430. And you have the anomalous situation in this case is if you allow a shareholder to continue to pursue claims after, for dissolution of a corporation, after he sold his shares, you run the risk of corporations of having to pay for the same shares twice.
Let me insert the issue that attends the waiver claim. Look, he sold his shares, and then he waived an appeal as a result of that. That's what the Court of Appeals stood on in their order. But the waiver has to be voluntary, and the argument contrary to your position is it wasn't voluntary. He was under a court order. How do you respond to that waiver?
Well, I'll respond in two ways, Your Honor, both by the facts and by the law. Just because there's a court order in place setting a closing date doesn't mean his compliance with that order was involuntary. If that were the rule, there would be no acceptance of the benefits doctrine, because every acceptance of the benefits case starts with a judgment or order requiring somebody to do something. So if that were the rule, then you might as well swallow the acceptance of benefits rule altogether, because it could never apply, because you always have a judgment or order. That's what they start with. But let's back up on the facts in this case. Jay Link made a motion to compel enforcement of that very judgment in October of 2008. We couldn't close at the time because of the credit crisis, and the judge had a reasonable time to close. A week later, we told them we're prepared to close because we've gone to the banks, spent $3 million, and are in a position now to be able to get the cash to close. He attended the hearings with the judge on the closing documents. We had the closing documents in place. He made objections. The court made changes to the objections. We then had a court enter an order saying these are the closing documents that are necessary to close the transaction. He has never once appealed that order saying there's anything wrong with the form of those documents. We have a closing. Jay Link voluntarily shows up at the closing, and he signs a stock transfer document. That's not one of the documents required even by the court's order. The document just simply says, I hereby sell, assign, and transfer my shares to Link Snacks in exchange for $19.4 million, or note for $19.4 million. That's the facts that led up to his decision. He voluntarily accepted the benefits and took that money, selling his shares. And that document, as I indicated, was not a document required by the court to be signed. He signed it and sold his shares. For those reasons, I think it's wrong to suggest that it was involuntary. He made a choice. He made a choice to sell his shares, and on the record we told him, look, as far as we're concerned, you can either, and the judge even said it, you can either sell your shares or you keep and ask for a stay, but you can't do both. And he knew full well what the consequence would be and nonetheless went forward and accepted the money and still accepts the money. And as we saw in the supplemental authority in answer to the question about how much he's received, he has since assigned that note to a bank and retained money from the bank for the note. So he's received more than the money that's been paid by Link Snack so far. And that was a supplemental authority we submitted about a month ago.
Counsel, how do you respond to opposing counsel's argument based on the Stevens case, Stevens Construction?
I respond as follows, Your Honor. In the Stevens case, the court said, where the appeal is confined to liability for the balance claim, the appellant does not waive his right to review by accepting the particular amount provided for in the judgment appealed from. As Mr. Abrahamian suggested, I think all the Stevens case stands for is the proposition that if it's impossible to get less, then you don't waive your appeal. But in this case, it is not impossible for him to get less. As I indicated before, the only way he can pursue his claims, both for dissolution and his money damage claim against Jack and Troy, is if the judgment for specific performance of the buy-sell agreement is reversed. That brings it down to zero. He can get much less than $19.4 million either in front of a jury as a damage component, if he ever had a trial. And by the way, we won't get into the merits here because of the waiver question, but there's lots of reasons why a jury doesn't have the ability to do what Mr. Apparinian says, and that's in our briefs. But the point is that he could do worse. A jury could assign any number of values for him.
Well, he didn't appeal, though. He didn't appeal the value. I think that's his position, that he can't challenge it either. I don't think either of you appealed the value as being a correct statement of what was due under the buy-sell.
No, everyone agrees $19.4 million is the correct number of the buy-sell agreement. But what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that to prevail on his claims, he must reverse the buy-sell agreement and have it thrown out so it would be zero. Because the only way it can happen, remember, the same stands for the judgment is claim for money from a jury in a damage case. I indicated before there's two claims he has that he claims survive. We've talked about the dissolution remedy, why he can't pursue that one. He also can't pursue his money damage claim against Jack and Troy because that case also depends upon the buy-sell agreement. He says, I'm assuming that the judgment will stand in place awarding $19.4 million for specific performance. If that's true, how can he possibly argue to a jury that there's something we wrongfully obtained Jay shares of $19.4 million when we did so pursuant to a judgment? He can't have it both ways.
If I understand your argument, the judgment of the 19 million stands because no one has objected to that or appealed. I understand your argument. In order to win on the other arguments, Jay has to, in effect, argue that judgment was not right. Might not overturn the judgment, but the whole argument is based, if you are correct, on the assumption that judgment was wrong. And that's a kind of judicial estoppel of his argument. Can't take one position in the case and then benefit from it and then take another position later on. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I also say, this is a new argument. This argument they have now is not the basis by which they proceeded up till now. They fully understood in this case that it was one or the other, dissolution or fair value buyout, fair market value buyout under the contract. They said to the appellate court, their notice of appeal included, hereby given that J-Link appeals to the Court of Appeals from that portion of the judgment entered on October 2nd in favor of Link Snacks, wherein the circuit court granted Link Snacks partial specific performance of a buy-sell agreement. In his appeal below, he said to the appellate court, Jay pursued a fair value buyout as a remedy under 180.14.30. However, not a buyout under the 1995 buy-sell agreement. See Childs. The 1995 buy-sell agreement and its non-competition provision should have been irrelevant as this court held in Decker. He cites Decker, which he claims holds that operating agreement provision was unenforceable in light of oppressive conduct. That's the way this case was tried from the start. It was one or the other.
And there were two issues on appeal, not as I understand it. He was asking for not only the dissolution, but also the damages
yes.
as a result of breach of fiduciary duty.
Sure. And let me address that more clearly, because I think I garbled it a minute ago. Basically, Your Honor, the reason he can't pursue that one is the same reason I articulated with why he can't pursue the claim for breach dissolution. He says that I'm entitled to the difference between fair market value and fair value as damages because they wrongfully obtained my shares at fair market value. That's the predicate that goes into his argument. How can we have wrongfully obtained his shares as long as a judgment in this case stands that says you can have civil performance of that contract, it's not wrong, your appropriate remedy, and there's no oppression involved in your obtaining it? He even says Exhibit A will be the judgment of the case. Well, if that's Exhibit A, he can't proceed because Exhibit A says there's nothing wrong with us buying his shares. That's the import of that judgment. We have a right to pursue that claim, and the court said there's nothing oppressive about that.
Well, how does that argument mesh with what your opposing counsel is stating, that the two claims are being brought against separate entities, the $19.4 million was the contractual cap, as I understand it, from the buy-sell agreement entered into in 1995 and then executed upon termination in 2005. And now what he's telling us he wants to pursue is a separate claim in regard to the individuals.
Here's how they square, Your Honor. At the end of the day, a corporation only acts through its officers and directors.
A corporation what?
Only can act through its officers and directors. In this case, the dissolution claim was on the basis that Jack and Troy supposedly had tried to squeeze Jay out of the company. That's their argument. It's the same argument they're saying for breach of fiduciary duty. The court said there was nothing wrong with the company buying his shares at that price. There was no oppression by the officers and directors. He's collaterally stopped from now saying there's something wrong with what they did when there's a judgment in place that says the corporation could do that. I guess I have 5 minutes left, and I'm happy to answer questions. I have 10 minutes remaining, but I did want to focus on our appeal just briefly, if I could. And there I'd like to make two broad statements. One of them is, the first, in a complex commercial litigation, which this was, a six-week jury trial, the time for filing post-trial motions where in a case that involves both judicial determinations and jury determinations does not begin to run until the end of the trial. And second, if there is a bright-line test that says, regardless of the circumstances, the time for filing an 805-16 motion must be filed in 20 days of the date of filing, and that rule has to shine brightly on both parties. And if that's the test, both parties filed their motions after the close of business on July 29th when they were due. A rule that basically allows the circuit court clerk to extend the court's jurisdiction and thereby exercise judicial powers should not be allowed to stand for the reasons this court articulated in St. John's.
Well, you know, the clerk of circuit court is a constitutional officer. And the court has a long history in sheriffs as to the sheriff being a constitutional officer and has powers that the legislature can't change without changing the Constitution. It has fewer cases dealing with the other named constitutional officers like district attorney, clerk of court, and there's a whole long list, and I haven't recited them all. So are you saying that there's no constitutional power here in the clerk to decide whether she'll leave it or he'll leave it open for another 2 minutes?
I think the clerk could keep the office open however long they want. The question is whether or not by filing after the deadline, the clerk determines whether that filing is timely.
So they can't pick and choose among the lawyers or pick and choose among the cases.
Right. And that's the problem in this case. I mean, I think the circuit court's ruling sums up the issue. He said, Jay Link's motions were filed 2 minutes after the close of business. Although the clerk of the court may exercise discretion in accepting papers for filing, Granado, Section 805.16 requires strict compliance. The appellate courts have not addressed whether the requirements of Section 805.16 are subject to the mandate of St. John's Home versus Continental Casualty.
That was our court's case, our clerk.
Yes.
Isn't there an additional factor there that his representative had called the clerk's office ahead of time? That's my reading of the record.
That's absolutely true. They called the clerk ahead of time, but he nonetheless filed it late. And the court went on to say, Your Honor, to that point.
Two minutes late, I think.
Absolutely.
4:32 as opposed to the regular closing time of 4:30.
That's correct. And the judge said, if the court applied that rule here, that is the St. John's case, Jay Link's post-verdict motions were untimely filed and the court lacks judicial competency to proceed. That is not this court's ruling, however, holding, however. The discretion to file pleadings received after official closing hours lies with the clerk, not the court. Ms. Nord filed the pleading, and this court is bound by the date stamped by the clerk. That's where I have a problem. The court itself could not exercise discretion to extend the time for filing the period beyond 4:30. At 4:30, the court lost competency to proceed. And yet the clerk somehow, by finding it is timely, creates jurisdiction for the circuit court to be able to consider the motion. While the clerk of the court certainly has discretionary powers and ministerial powers, they do not have judicial powers. They don't have the ability to say or extend jurisdiction to the court.
Counsel, I see those as two separate and distinct issues. If someone presents documents to a clerk and the clerk accepts them and file stamps them and puts them in the file, that's the clerk's responsibility. I mean, the clerk accepts all sorts of things that may not have anything to do with a case, but they still have to accept them and put them in the file. But in the end, the buck stops with the judge to determine whether or not there's jurisdiction, regardless of whether a clerk accepts a document.
I agree wholeheartedly, and that's the failure of this case. The judge said, I would otherwise have found it to be untimely, but I am bound by what the clerk stamped on the document, and he followed the Granato decision. To accept the appellate court reasoning here, this court has to accept Granato. It has to accept the notion that a clerk somehow has the power to extend judicial powers beyond a certain time. I agree wholeheartedly. The clerk can accept the time, accept a file stamp, but what the court does with it is the court's business, and only the court can say whether it's late or timely. But in this case, the judge said, I'm bound to what the clerk said because of Granato, and I don't have any discretion, and otherwise I would have found it was untimely.
If we accept the argument that J was untimely, what issues remain before this court, in your opinion?
If you accept the issue that J's was untimely, and both were untimely then it simply goes back to the circuit court and the jury's original verdict in its full glory of $5 million, the wash for each of them gets reinstated the way it was. I believe that the other appeals that Mr. Abrahamian raised are waived, so they wouldn't go anywhere. But if the only issue was that one, the only thing remaining to be done was tell the circuit court, reinstate the jury's verdict as originally contemplated and given by the parties, the $5 million wash, not a $5 million windfall.
So it only affects that, the punitive damage issue.
Correct.
Was that the that's the $5 million, right?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Abrahamian?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe I have 10 minutes to address a rebuttal on our petition as well as the response to theirs. One of the things that Mr. Norton said that Justice Bradley talked about, I think rephrased it, but I don't think is exactly right. We never pursued enforcement of the contract, the buy-sell agreement. They pursued enforcement of that buy-sell agreement. They pursued specific performance. That wasn't our claim. That was their claim. And the judgment that came out ordered us to comply and sell those shares. It was not voluntarily done. There was an order to do it. They have yet to cite one case from any court. The Court of Appeals didn't cite a case. The opposition didn't cite a case that said one could forfeit their rights on appeal that were accrued and pending because they complied with a court order requiring them to do something. We cited a case from 1876 that would be unheard of, the Supreme Court said, to require a forfeiture, to hold a forfeiture because you're relying and complying with a court order to do this.
Mr. Norton says you always have a judgment. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here.
That's not true.
Okay. Tell me why.
The Stevens construction case. Nothing required Stevens in that case to pursue that money. Stevens construction held it was a conditional judgment. If you want to pursue the money, which was a partial payment on some lien foreclosures on some condo units, you can pursue that money, and you have to execute releases on those claims. They didn't have to pursue that partial payment. They did. They could have stayed, they could have sat on it, and they could have done nothing while they pursued to try and get the full amount on those lien foreclosures. What they did was they pursued, got the partial payment, executed the releases pursuant to the judgment, and then sued for the entire payment. And this court held that there was no waiver, that they didn't need to get a stay. Why didn't they need to get a stay? Because it was impossible for them to get less. They got the partial payment in Stevens Construction.
Does breach of fiduciary or oppression position undercut the judgment on the buy-sell?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Let's start with the breach of fiduciary duty. It's against different parties. We did not challenge the buy-sell agreement on appeal. They'd note that we put in our notice of appeal. There are a lot of issues you put in a notice of appeal that you don't pursue, and if you don't pursue them, they're abandoned. That's the Riemann Associates case. That's footnote one of our reply brief. They had a whole list of issues that they put in their notice of appeal, including the LSI Nuclearis judgment that they never ended up pursuing. They're abandoned. Even if we succeeded on that, on our appeal, it would not affect that buy-sell because we didn't pursue that issue.
Counsel, if you're not a shareholder, how do you pursue that claim?
The breach of fiduciary duty claim? That's notes. That's directly this court's case in notes that said, even though they're not a shareholder and they're divested of their interest, those issues and those claims accrued when they were a shareholder, when they were a fiduciary, and when those rights were violated. And they had a right to pursue those claims for breach of fiduciary duty, even though they've lost the status. He was a shareholder, and in notes, they were shareholders at the time the claim was being pursued.
So how much statute there?
No, that relates to the oppression claim, Your Honor, not the breach of fiduciary duty. Justice Crooks and his majority decision in that case made clear under the fiduciary duty that has nothing to do with the statute, because the statute relates to the judicial dissolution part of it. At the time he is a shareholder, he is owed fiduciary duties, and if they breach, that claim accrues. Whether subsequently down the road he loses that shareholder status, the injury occurred while he was a shareholder.
So how would you measure the injury? How would you measure the damages? Would there be double counting?
It would not be double counting because, Your Honor, the measure of damages is the ill-gotten gain. It's not a fair value. This, again, is mischaracterizing our claim. They do it in the briefing below. We never sought fair value as damages for breach of fiduciary duty. It has always been the ill-gotten gain, which is a difference. It's a delta between the amount that the company has to pay under the buy-sell and the value of the shares that now the shareholders got the benefit of despite their breach of fiduciary duty. There's a lot of cases, we cited them both in our briefing before this court, but also in the Court of Appeals below, that says this is a standard type of remedy. And as it relates to the waiver, we are not challenging the $19.4 million, neither are they. Therefore, under Stevens' construction, it's impossible for us to get less. And that's the key. They're mixing the merits of the claims and the argued waiver below. Maybe we won't win on breach of fiduciary duty damages on the merits. Maybe we're not entitled to an oppression finding on the merits. But our argument is there shouldn't have been a waiver, and they should be decided on the merits. I feel good about our briefing on the merits, but whether we win or lose, that's not the issue before this court. The issue before this court is, was there a waiver? And because it's impossible for us to get less under the Stevens construction, there's no way there should have been a waiver.
You know, one of the arguments opposing counsel makes, or at least as I understood it, is that the court didn't find oppression, so you can't go back to that. And the reason he didn't find oppression is because they were seeking specific performance, which is an equitable remedy, and the court wouldn't have granted an equitable remedy if there had been oppression. Can you respond to that?
I can, please? And we can refer to this very case, the LSI Nuglaris decision relating to another company in this case. Mm-hmm. The court held and awarded specific performance of the amended bylaws there, which would have required a fair market value payment, but it awarded fair value because it said Jay did not breach any duties to that company. So Jay got a fair value payment as a statutory remedy there, even though the enforcement of the buy-sell was done. All we're asking for is a differential. And again, this is an equitable remedy that the court can apply under the statute. It can say the company has already paid Link Snacks has already paid $19.4 million. Because we're finding oppression, Jay's entitled to more. He's entitled to the fair value of the shares, just like in the notes case in your concurring opinion, Justice Rogensack. It's all about money at that point. And just because he got a payment of money...
It's always all about money.
Exactly. Just because he got a payment of money doesn't mean he's not entitled to additional money if, in fact, there is a remedy under the dissolution statute.
I'm not maybe saying my question well. The court granted opposing parties specific performance of the buy-sell agreement. That's equitable remedy. Do you agree?
Yes.
Okay. And you are claiming that you should have gotten a finding, or we should make a finding based on the facts of record, that there was oppression. But the court specifically didn't find oppression.
That's correct.
Okay.
It did not
find
oppression.
And I understood part of their argument to be that if he had been oppressed, the court wouldn't have granted specific performance of the buy-sell agreement. So if they're correct, you can't go back and do the oppression. If they're not correct, I want you to tell me why.
It's unclear what the judge would have done had he found the oppression and whether he would have enforced it or not. I think the key is, Your Honor, is that it's an equitable remedy. And it goes back on remand. We were forced to sell the shares pursuant to the buy-sell. And we got $19.4 million, which we view as a partial payment. I'm not
Yeah, we're not connecting, but yeah. Go ahead with somebody else's question. I'll have to think about it more.
I want to make sure I have I address their response to their petition because I don't have an
answer. I think Justice Ziegler had a question.
Do you agree or disagree that liquidation is the remedy for oppression? That's what counsel said.
Liquidation, the claim is for judicial dissolution. You get judicial dissolution of the company if you prove oppression. Typically, because it's an ongoing business, the courts don't dissolve the company, but they give an alternative remedy. The alternative remedy oftentimes is fair value for the shares. So in lieu of dissolution because it's an ongoing company, the remedy is fair value. And the court has discretion in awarding a remedy. Here, it would be innocuous. If for every right there's a remedy, if Jay has a right to a remedy because he was oppressed, that somehow he would get, as a result of that remedy and a finding of oppression, he would get less than he was entitled to under the contract? If there's oppression, he's entitled to get more. He's entitled to a remedy. Otherwise, it's no remedy at all because he's getting exactly what he would get under the contract.
If there's no oppression, can you get more damages than the jury awarded you on breach of contract?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
If there is no oppression, can you get more damages than the jury awarded you for breach of contract?
Absolutely. Well, not for breach of contract. We're stuck on the breach of contract.
I'm sorry. I said the wrong thing.
For breach of fiduciary duty.
Breach of fiduciary duty.
Absolutely,
Your
Honor. That's a different claim against different parties with a different standard. And, again, that goes to the merits of whether we're entitled to get an ill-gotten gain jury instruction and a right to recover that. Again, that doesn't go to the waiver. That goes to the merits. But clearly, under established case law, we're entitled to that measure of damages for breach of fiduciary duty, separate and apart from oppression, separate and apart from contract.
Okay.
And that's measured by the differential.
And I assume you asked for jury instructions supporting.
We did, and they're cited in our appendix.
Thank you.
Counsel, Chief, if I may.
Justice Bradley.
Several times you've mentioned if you prevail, there should be a remand, and you've indicated to the circuit court, if you would prevail, why wouldn't the remand be to the Court of Appeals? The Court of Appeals indicated that they weren't going to address your issues on appeal because you have waived them. And if you are successful on that waiver, voluntary versus involuntary discussion, then why wouldn't the remand be to the Court of Appeals?
I agree it would, Your Honor. There's a miscommunication. I thought we were talking hypothetically if we win on the merits, do we get a remand? If we win on the merits of our argument, we would get a remand, and then the Circuit Court would be entitled to award a remedy. But if we win on the issue here on waiver, if the Court's not going to consider the merits, a remand to the Court of Appeals is the appropriate remedy to consider the merits. I'd like to address, I see my red light is on. I haven't had a chance to respond to their petition.
Well, you've got about 60 seconds to wind up.
They raised one issue in their petition, Your Honor. When a complicated commercial trial is trifurcated so that there are separate and sequential adjudications of the party's several equitable and legal claims, does WSSTAT 805.16 require that post-trial motions be filed at the end of each phase of the litigation and before the trial itself is completed? That's the only issue they raised. They never raised an issue about Jay's timeliness in their petition. Matter of fact, they never brought a motion challenging that, not in the circuit court, not in the Court of Appeals. They've argued and noted maybe Jay's is untimely too, give us the benefit on ours, but they never brought a motion to strike our filing, and our filing was made within 20 days of the jury verdicts. Jury verdicts were issued on July 9th. The filing is July 29th. There's nothing in the rules that said it has to be by 4:30 or 5 o'clock. Whenever it is, it says on that day. It was filed on that day. Circuit court clerks have discretion that they exercise routinely. Their proposal for a one-size-fits-all, you close the doors at the end of business hours, is a solution in search of a problem. There's no issue here. There's a standard of law that applies for abuse of discretion cases relating to the clerk here. It was 2 minutes. They've never suggested that 2 minutes is an abuse of discretion. It was filed within 20 days. We met the deadline. They didn't. They didn't even give the opportunity to the clerk to exercise discretion because they mailed it at 11:58 and 03 from Chicago on July 29th, the day it was due.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Norton.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The rule is clear. A party waives his right to appeal when he accepts the fruits of the judgment to which he may not be entitled if his appeal succeeds. And a corollary to that rule is a party is not precluded from taking an appeal which does not involve a reversal of that judgment, of the judgment under which he has received payment. As indicated at the outset, the only way he can prevail on this claim is if he gets a reversal of that judgment. They cannot stand together. They are mutually exclusive, and they hold fundamentally different propositions. He cannot pursue his claim for damages in front of a jury on the basis that somehow we had ill-gotten gains when the court has concluded there's nothing ill-gotten about that judgment. We, for goodness sakes, we're buying on a share pursuant to a judgment. How can that be ill-gotten? As to the merits of his claim on below, and I don't want, it's really not a question for this court, but he's raised it a couple of times, he didn't have a right to argue to the jury that he was entitled to ill-gotten gains below for several different reasons. One, there is no fiduciary duty of a corporation to buy out a shareholder at a price he deems acceptable to him. And that's
the
Regent case.
The breach of fiduciary duty lies against Jack and Troy. It doesn't lie against the company. And the buy-sell agreement was an effective agreement, though I guess it could have been otherwise, between the company and Jay. So I think you've got different claims. He didn't claim or prevail, at least, on a claim that the company breached its fiduciary duty to him as a company. He prevailed on a claim that two individuals breached their fiduciary duties to him.
Correct. And what he's arguing now, however, is that somehow those two individuals got ill-gotten gains by acquiring the company at $19.4 million. That's his current claim. He's saying, I'm entitled to that and the difference. So he's arguing that the two directors of the corporation, Jack and Troy, breached fiduciary duties because they're getting the ill-gotten gains of that contract. And it stands to reason that if that contract was enforceable by the court and found not to be abusive, that they cannot have breached fiduciary duties and have no ill-gotten gains. And by the way, that's why the court below did not instruct the jury on the theory that Mr. Abrahamian advocates. There was no ill-gotten gains in this case for a simple reason. Jack and Troy did not buy Jay's shares at the time of trial. They didn't have his shares. Jay still had his shares. The court had not enforced the judgment for specific performance. That didn't happen until a month and a half later, only after the court made its determination that there was no oppression. So to do what Mr. Abrahamian suggests, you're going to have the anomalous situation of having the judge, having a jury second-guess a court, because he's going to get in front of a jury and say, I'm entitled to fair value for my shares. Mind you, there's no cases that say that's a measure of damages, but assume he's going to do that. Because it was wrongful that they got the shares for $19.5 million, pay no attention to the judgment of the circuit court below.
Sounds to me then, so I heard Jay's lawyer, he's relying heavily that you got two different parties. And you're saying, yeah, there are two different parties, but it's all interrelated.
It clearly is. It's all the same conduct. And again, I go back to the proposition that he's saying that Jack and Troy somehow got an ill-gotten gain
right. Because
the company bought Jay shares at a reduced
right. Price. And this was not a buy-sell among the shareholders. This was a buy-sell with the company.
The company had the first option. The shareholders had the second option, but the company had the first option.
The company paid, right?
Exactly. The
company paid. Now they're saying, well, that's a lot of money that they've lost because the company got it for $19 million.
A lot of money that he lost.
Yeah. That's their argument.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, he got what he bargained for under the contract. When he got his shares in the first place, he agreed, I'll take fair market value for my shares if I'm terminated for any reason. That's the bargain he struck. And what he's trying to do now is get around his bargain, get around his contract, the contract that said that's what you get if you leave. You can do worse than fair market value. Fair market value is what a willing buyer pays a willing seller. That's what he could have sold his shares for on the street. It's not liquidation value. It's not book value. You could do a lot worse than fair market value, but that's what he agreed to. And in this case, he mentioned oppression. The court found there was no oppression. And the reason he found there was no oppression is because he balanced the equities in the case. And he balanced the equities and concluded that Jack's conduct paled in comparison to Jay's conduct. And I don't want to get into all the facts of this case. We litigated for 6 weeks in the summer 2 years ago.
How long did it take for the jury to make its decision?
I think it was 3 days they came back, by recollection. I'm not going to get into the facts of the case, but I don't think we have to. At the end of the day, all we have in front of us to determine what happened was the verdicts. And the verdicts are contrary to any sort of notion that Jay was squeezed out by management as part of some scheme. First of all, the judge found there was no oppression. The jury found that J-Link breached his fiduciary duties before he left the company and afterwards, and did so in intentional disregard of rights or maliciously. The jury also find that J-Link breached the departure memorandum. In that agreement, he agreed to leave the companies. If Jay were wrongfully terminated, the jury could not have found that he breached that agreement. The jury also found that he had tortiously interfered with the contract. As for Jack and Troy, Troy, they found breached fiduciary duties, but caused $0 in damages to Jay. The other officers and directors, who they claim were part of the conspiracy to throw him out of the company, were found by a cumulative vote, I believe, of 53-1, to have breached no fiduciary duties. So based on the verdicts we have, you cannot rationally conclude that Jay was squeezed out of the company or avoid the judge's conclusion that there was no oppression. At the end of the day, it doesn't strike me as oppressive that a shareholder should get precisely what he bargained for when he got his shares in the first place.
Did Jay ever claim for rights under the buy-sell agreement as a contract claim?
He never claimed for rights in the buy-sell agreement. The only claim he ever made was a motion to enforce the judgment for buy-sell agreement. He made a motion.
He didn't assert a claim. The buy-sell agreement came up. Did it come up as a defense on your part, or how did it get in the case?
The case originally claimed, we started the case, he refused to cooperate with the buy-sell agreement. Okay. We brought a claim for specific performance of the buy-sell agreement.
The buy-sell, so it was your claim to start with.
Correct. Okay. He asserted oppression as a defense and as an affirmative claim under 1430.
Okay, good. Thank you.
You're welcome. The other point I'd like to touch on is the shareholder standing issue, because I think the Knotts case is clearly distinguishable from this situation. I mean, you do have a danger in this situation that wasn't present in Knotts, I don't believe, that if you allow a shareholder who's been bought out and no longer has any interest in the company to continue a claim for dissolution of every company, you send a shiver down the spine of the business community every time they buy out a shareholder to think that that shareholder, nonetheless, can turn around and still sue them for dissolution having been bought out. The problem with that is, let's assume in this case that J-Link, instead of selling his shares to Link Snacks, had sold them to a third party. And the conduct that Jay claims was oppressive continued against the new third party. Would that third party and Jay both be able to pursue remedies for the fair value buyout of the shares, such that the company has to pay for the fair value twice? Once he's no longer a shareholder, he doesn't have a right to bring a dissolution claim. Dissolution, at the end of the day, is a buyout remedy. It's intended to allow a buyout in the worst possible circumstance. If all else fails, a shareholder can get his equity paid out by having the corporation dissolved and liquidated. That's what it is. His shares are bought out. There's no standing to continue to pursue a claim to dissolve that corporation. We're not aware of any case that has ever held that a shareholder who voluntarily accepts the benefits can nonetheless pursue a dissolution of a case. And we've cited cases.
I don't know that it's quite as broad as you're stating it. I think to be comprehensive, we have to add in there pursuant to court order.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that would be correct, pursuant to court order. And I'm not suggesting that is wrongly decided because, again, that was 1106. That's a different standard and a different statute involved. But in this case, the fact of the matter is Jay did voluntarily accept the benefits. The notion that somehow he did it involuntarily does not square with the record. I don't know how you get around the fact that he made a motion to compel this very judgment. And ultimately, Link Snacks still hasn't explained, we spent $3 million to get that judgment closed. How are we ever going to get that money back? And that's the ultimate problem with the acceptance of the benefits doctrine. It's intended to prevent harm to us when we rely upon what he did, when he could get less by virtue of the fact that if the judgment is thrown out, and it has to be for both his claims, who knows what he'll get for fair value or what he would get at all for the corporation. A court's dissolution is a remedy the court has in its complete discretion. It can award anything. The standard is not, could I get more? The standard is it impossible to get less? In this case, it's not impossible to get less. The court could award him whatever it wanted to. It could say, you know, I find the parties both of unclean hands. I'm going to leave you where I find you. That's less than $19.4 million. Likewise, the jury in this case could easily come back and say, damages, we find that they're $100,000. It's not impossible to get less from a jury. And for those reasons, we're at risk. We've spent $3 million to close the transaction. He showed up at the closing. He tendered the shares. In response to his comment that no court has ever found that's voluntary, we cite in our brief several cases, not in Wisconsin, all of which make clear it doesn't matter whether it's under an order of court or a judgment of the case. That's not the basis for the rule. He wasn't held in contempt of court. He had options. He could have asked for a stay of the order. He didn't. He could have said to the judge, I cannot comply with the order. He didn't. He went to the closing, voluntarily signed a document selling his shares, and took the money. He waived.
I see there are 13 separate boxes in this case of record. Do you happen to have the record number of where he moved to compel the specific performance? I gather you do.
Yes, Your Honor. You can find that at our app, 349. So that's the appendix to our response at 349.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes our arguments in Link Snacks, Inc. versus J.E. Link. And very interesting series of questions relating to corporate practice and fiduciary duties. I want to thank all the counsel for their excellent briefs and their excellent arguments today. And we conclude with 08-AP-2897, Link Snacks, Inc. versus J.E. Link. The court will be in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third case. And those who wish to stay can do so, and the justice will be out shortly to discuss the procedures in this case. We are in recess.